Hello and welcome to the third instalment of the EDPS series of podcasts exploring digital ethics. I'm Christian Dacuna and I'll be your host for this discussion. 80 years from now, according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, if we continue on our current trajectory, the planet will be 4 degrees warmer. This will result in the drowning of hundreds of cities. Many more cities in India and the Middle East will be so hot in the summer that anyone stepping outside would be risking their lives. In Europe, the summer of 2002, which killed 35,000 Europeans, will become a normal summer. Meanwhile, conflict and population displacement will reach unprecedented scales. To avert this catastrophe, the IPCC say we have just 12 years to cut carbon emissions in half. The longer we wait, the higher the rate of reduction that will be needed. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said that we basically have less than 1 year to change course. And the new Finnish presidency of the Council of the EU has said that addressing climate change is Europe's next heroic act. There is simply no more urgent concern facing humanity. What does this have to do with digital technology? The terms digital, cyber, online, virtual are used interchangeably. They don't mean exactly the same thing, but they all suggest something ethereal, non-physical, abstract. An escape from the messy, real, material world. We're encouraged to aspire to paperless offices, cashless economies, all the world's information stored in the cloud, retrievable instantaneously. Algorithms with minimal human input optimize global supply chains and resolve hundreds of billions of real-time transactions every day in finance and online advertising. Yet the notion of escape from the material realm is a myth. Take cryptocurrencies. Mining Bitcoin generates as much CO2 as a million transatlantic flights. That's more electricity than is generated by all of the world's solar panels combined. And you can attribute the depletion of 3,000 kilometers of the Arctic ice sheet to such levels of emission. Smartphones have an average life of under 5 years, and they depend on so-called rare earths, which are so weakly concentrated in the clay where they are mined that the leftovers, tons of leftovers, are dumped, polluting streams and hills. We're told that more and more data are needed to train AI systems to be able to compete with China and the US. But training a single neural network model for natural language is estimated to produce nearly 5 times the emissions produced by the average car over its lifetime. Meanwhile, the tech giants are collaborating with big oil and gas companies to locate and extract more fossil fuels. Is this sustainable? How should scientists and engineers and businesses reflect on the impact of the digital technologies they're developing? Is the entire growth-oriented public policy imperative responsible for the precarious state we're in? Or could digital technology really help slow down global warming through techniques like carbon capture or geoengineering? I'm joined by Andrew Brennan, Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at La Trobe University in Melbourne and expert in environmental ethics, Heather Iqbal, Senior Advisor at Global Witness, a nonprofit working on the links between natural resources, conflict and corruption, and Ruben Decker, expert on sustainable consumption and production at the European Commission. Heather Iqbal, can you please describe for us some aspects of the environmental impact of digitalization around the world?
Certainly. I mean, there's definitely a growing challenge when it comes to the demand, for example, the metals needed to build the smartphones, which you just talked about, but also the minerals needed for renewable technology and clean energy batteries. And the big important question around that is how we ensure we're not creating a supply chain for those materials that leads to environmental destruction and human rights abuses or that continuing acceleration on the breakdown of our climate. And I think in a way it's really important to recognize that this is in some ways not a new thing, you know, something extremely concerning and something which we've been focusing on for quite some time at Global Witness is how the global trade in a variety of minerals has funded some of the world's most brutal conflicts for decades. You know, minerals often referred to as conflict minerals, resources from conflict or high-risk areas such as parts of Afghanistan, Colombia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zimbabwe, can provide lucrative funding to armed groups and a link to, you know, kind of wide environmental degradation. And it's important to make the link between those resources entering the global supply chain and driving that impact of digital and data intensive technology, you know, ending up in our mobile phones and our laptops and other products. And, you know, they're traded on commodity exchanges worldwide, they're swapped by banks, and they're a favorite vehicle for investors worldwide. So increasing technologies that are driving this digital revolution rely on these kind of materials. And it's really important for us to make that link and see that this kind of environmental impact stretches all the way back across that supply chain.
Thank you. Andrew Brennan, you've written about environmental ethics. Could you explain what you mean by the term?
I'm pleased to be talking in this conversation all the way from Australia. Thank you for inviting me. The growth of environmental ethics actually started a long time ago, but it only took its contemporary form in the 1970s and 1980s. I'll just mention a couple of people that have been influential. In the United States, there was a forester called Arthur Leopold, who put forward a view about the importance of what he called the land, which nowadays we might call the ecological community. And he said, a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, beauty, and stability of the land. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. And this was quite an upheaval in ethical thinking, because what he was suggesting, therefore, is that instead of thinking about our duties to other people and our duties to our children primarily, we should be thinking more about doing what's right for the environmental and ecological community. And quite separate from him, over in Norway, Arne Næss came up with a philosophy that he called deep ecology. But like Leopold, it was unlike Leopold in some ways, but in other ways it was like Leopold. Like Leopold, he wanted to argue for the value of all living things, not just the value of human beings. And so he put forward initially a view about biospheric egalitarianism, namely the view that everything, even non-living things like mountains and rivers, had some kind of value in their own right. And later on in his life, Næss backed down from the egalitarian bit of that. Social democracy for all of the environment was a bit too radical. But what he did say was that everything has value. It might be that human beings have a bit more value than other people. And this idea of the intrinsic value of nature and natural things then started to take off, and people saw this as defining what the project of environmental philosophy was going to be. And so that's a short and potted history of what happened in getting environmental ethics developed. And since then, of course, it's become increasingly common nowadays for everyone to talk about the value of nature and not to think it shocking and surprising as it was back in the 70s and 80s to talk about natural things having a value in their own right.
Thanks for condensing so much into such a short answer. Would you say that our understanding has evolved since the beginnings with Leopold, or is it basically the same notion which has become more taken more on more of a general currency amongst people generally?
Well, I think things have evolved. There have been quite fun elements in the history of environmental philosophy, and they keep being repeated nowadays. There was a group in Australia recently that put forward the suggestion that the Great Barrier Reef should be given Australian citizenship. The idea that they had there was that if the Great Barrier Reef is a citizen, then it has a right to be protected from mining runoff and sedimentation and shipping. And also it's able to, someone could take up a lawsuit on its behalf and sue governments or mining companies for damage sustained by the reef. Now, that it's interesting that that view has been put forward, because it shows how much the focus has shifted away from human exceptionalism and the thought that only human beings have rights to a thought that lots of items in the natural world have rights, and that humans are not so special. Human consciousness, for instance, used to be thought to be one of the things that distinguished us from animals, from plants, from rivers and mountains. But it's hard to see why having consciousness should make you so morally special that you ignore the demands of the rest of the ecological system.
And if you like, you could say that this notion of human exceptionalism is the underlying philosophy for the human rights framework, from the UN Declaration of Human Rights to the EU's Charter of Fundamental Rights, where we speak of the dignity and freedom of the individual human being.
That's right. And many people nowadays see that as a kind of throwback to an earlier religious and particularly Christian viewpoint about human beings being made in the image of God. And because they are the creation of God and in his image, they have a special status that no other living thing or no other natural thing has on the planet. And that kind of human exceptionalism has actually persisted quite well, even though religion has declined and the number of people who claim to be believers is lower now than it has been from forever, actually. Nonetheless, that kind of human exceptionalism, that humans have got a special property that distinguishes them from other things, has been very powerful in our thinking. And it underlies lots of our economic thinking and lots of our everyday consumer thinking. When we regard natural things as just resources or raw materials from which we make commodities, as if they don't have some kind of standing in their own right.
Could I turn to Ruben and ask about the policy dimension of all of this? We've looked at the supply chains and overview of the environmental impact and some of the ethical questions. In the European Commission, in policy discussions, we've had various schemes over the years to try to incentivize reduction in pollution. I'm thinking of emissions trading and cap and trade. They've had limited success. What are your views, Ruben, on how to make individuals, businesses, and governments accountable for what they do and the environmental impact that they have?
Yes, thanks, Christian. Well, I think obviously as a response and as a consequence of the developments that Andrew talked about, we have set up worldwide and certainly also in the EU a policy framework to try and reduce the impacts of humankind, I would say, on the environment, and to ensure that that we keep the planet in a state for ourselves and our children and grandchildren. I'll keep it short and not bore you with an endless overview of all the policy tools that we have, but I would categorize it sort of in three main elements, especially as concerns the relationship to the digital. I think on the one hand, you've already mentioned ETS. When it comes to within the EU, we have a wide range of policy instruments aimed at climate and environment. ETS is one, obviously aimed at setting a price for CO2 emissions. Other instruments we have affect products on the EU market, setting design requirements aimed at making products more sustainable, or in other ways, setting incentives for sustainable products through, for instance, green public procurement or certain labeling schemes. And we have rules that address the waste phase, so setting targets for recycling and making sure waste is handled properly and recycled as much as possible. I think a second layer of policy is more the multilateral dimension, the Paris Agreement, specifically for climate, but there's also lots of environmental multilateral agreements, which are aimed at the global level and which I think are very important in the context of these global supply chains. The effects of the products that we have here typically are elsewhere, so it's very important that these countries are on board. And then thirdly, looking specifically at digitalization, here we are looking at what that means with circular economy, and this is more still a bit in development, but we do see opportunities also arising from digitalization. I mean, the fact that we are now talking with people from all over the world without having physically traveled saves, of course, emissions. So in the dematerialization of things, the sharing models that are made possible with digital platforms, the Internet of Things and the availability of data, offers opportunities for maintenance and for better product management. So we do also see chances for that, but we're aware that we need to make sure that we also limit the potential negative aspects. So that's sort of the balancing game we try to play.
Thanks. And how would you, staying with you, Ruben, how would you evaluate the success of these efforts, not just the ones in the EU, but more generally in international discussions? Is there anything that has been, which has had an impact so far that we can say that's something to invest more energy in?
Well, speaking of energy, I think one very successful policy tool we've had has been the Ecodesign Directive, which I already briefly mentioned. I don't have the numbers in front of me now, but I know we typically say that this directive has helped make devices on the EU market so much more energy efficient that it saves on the annual consumption of a country the size of Italy. So we do see, and we have some figures showing the real progress we're making in terms of being smarter with the resources we use. That said, I think we're not there, especially if we know that in the digitalizing world, in the digital economy, we'll have more and more devices. Even if each device uses less energy, we will also have to address that. So how can we provide the energy, and how can we make these devices efficient enough that the growth in digitalization does not go together with a growth in energy use and in production of waste from electronics? So this is something we're working on.
Thank you. Heather, if I could come back to you, Global Witness talk about climate justice. Would you be able to explain to us what you mean by that?
Yes, absolutely. I think I just listened with great interest around Andrew's comments about sort of human exceptionalism and there being this kind of a growing playoff between sort of protecting the environment and protecting the climate and what that means to people. And I guess if there's a kind of a sacrificial undertone to that, solving that problem. I mean, for us, climate justice covers a huge swathe of issues, but particularly around how, you know, to end the degradation of the planet, we also have to think about how our activities impact on humans. When it comes to projects, mining, anything like that, which affects huge swathes of land. So recently, you know, the term climate justice has been used a lot in the encouraging kind of green swell of support in Europe and in, I guess, what we call the global north. But I think this climate emergency has been happening in what we call the global south at the moment for a huge amount of time. You know, for generations there are, for example, indigenous communities in Brazil who have been fighting for climate justice, which not only means protecting the local environment in which they live, but also in stopping a kind of rampant degradation from huge industries like agribusiness, like mining, like illegal logging. And I think that for us, the biggest thing behind climate justice is, yes, certainly not kind of extracting more fossil fuels from the ground and certainly not trying to contribute to that immediate carbon impact, but it's also about the long-term protection of communities, not displacing them off their land. We know that local communities are the best stewards of climate critical forests. We know that people protect the environment extremely well when they are given the legitimacy and empowered to do so. So for us, climate justice is a kind of, yes, it's about European citizens and policymakers putting pressure on the voices that can change policy, that stop environmental destruction and create that breakdown. But it's also about making sure that we protect people like land and environmental defenders, and that we think about how things like a Green New Deal or something like that impacts on those people and whether we're protecting them enough and through them ensuring that we have long-term sustainable climate justice that protects both people and planet.
And you said that this is a new problem, certainly for the global south. It predates digitization, which is a phenomenon of only the last 20 or so years. But would you say that injustices are growing or that they've remained fairly stable? And if so, why and how? Could you give us some a flavour of the trends over recent years?
Sure. I mean, for me, I guess there's a few different strands of this. One is around the increasing, I guess, accountability being posed to our financial sector and the investors, banks and funds that pump money into things like fossil fuels or big projects, which can have a huge impact on the environment. So I think the trend there is more people are kind of coming wise to the fact that the money is being pumped through things like our pension funds into damaging projects like this. But there's also, like, you know, similarly a huge pushback by the fossil fuel industries and by investors to continue unhindered in that activity. I mean, you spoke when you introduced the podcast about the IPCC report. I mean, we know that the amount of investments coming from fossil fuel companies into fossil fuel projects is something like $5 trillion. Global Witness recently did a report which showed that those investments mean it's basically impossible for us to reach those Paris agreements if they continue to invest at the rate that they've pledged to do. So there's both a growing awareness of this trend, but also like a growing and a kind of a willingness for the fossil fuel industries and certain investors to kind of cut themselves off from that by offering a kind of facade of like kind of alternative options when they are continuing to plough money into these sort of projects. There have over the last few years continually been a trend around agribusiness and the impact on land and environmental defenders across the world, and particularly indigenous communities. I mean, we've seen over the last week some pretty frightening stuff happening in Brazil, the opening up of the Amazon to huge agribusiness companies and the agribusiness lobby by Bolsonaro. That's deeply concerning. So I think there's a kind of drive for finance, a drive for business, which is continuing to drive this environmental degradation and the impact on communities that are trying to live off that land or have lived there for generations.
Thanks. This is a question, you know, for any of you who want to wants to step in. Related to this point about climate justice, globalization has resulted in, I can't remember the figure, but it's billions of people have been lifted out of poverty. Largely in China because of the rapid growth there, but also in other parts of the world. Alongside that, people have, you know, been in many ways liberated by having their own handheld devices. I think in Africa, large swathes of the population have skipped having PCs and have gone straight to having mobile computers in their pockets. The benefit which has been derived by billions of people as a result of globalization and digitization. But at the same time, there's evidence that, you know, inequality is growing, and it's inequality not only of wealth, but also access to technology and the terms of access to technology. So, you know, do any of you have any reflections on the role of, you know, environmental protection in trying to address inequality as well as safeguarding the environment? Because often it seems, you know, to take the green movement over here, that we were talking before the podcast about how the green parties have been exceptionally successful in the European parliamentary elections in May, but they're largely associated with being a fairly sort of comfortable middle class movement, and you know, the sort of poorer, more vulnerable members of society don't seem to have been taken up by that agenda. Do you have any thoughts on how that can be addressed?
I can dive in with an initial thought from my side. I think yeah, like you say, the recent green movement is extremely encouraging. You know, some of the protests that have been taking place are extremely encouraging. But the climate movement across the rest of the world has been happening for a very long time. So it's extremely important to make sure that people from that climate movement are heard in Europe, and that, you know, we bear in mind the impact that green technology can also have on those communities. I mean, that also comes down to, I guess, like at a deeper policy level, you know, when people are kind of saying that they have appropriately assessed both, you know, all of environmental, social and governance risks. Often the environmental aspect of that is paid attention to, but then, you know, something like a hydropower dam can be built on an indigenous community's land, displace many people and sort of reinforce those really damaging structures of inequality that you talked about. So I think it's about making sure that the climate movement is globally inclusive and that we don't speak on other for other people not on their own terms, and make sure that those voices are heard when we're considering and building these policies to move forward.
It seems to me, I mean, one of the things that philosophers recently have been talking about is the complexity of the global warming issue. And this relates to what Heather's just been talking about, because there's a number of asymmetries that make it very difficult to come to a clear ethical view on these issues. Two of the asymmetries are the asymmetry between the rich and the poor. And that can be within a country, the rich people and the poor people within a country. And it can also be across the globe, the asymmetry between the rich world and the poor world. In the case of asymmetry like that, there's not any mutuality. The privileged side of the duality has got power over the less privileged side. And we see this in all sorts of activities, like the disposal of e-waste into poorer countries, where people are exposed to toxic pollution in dismantling their computers and their phones and the other waste that turns up. But there's also another asymmetry that's present here and that does relate to the climate justice issue, which is the asymmetry between the present and the future. And again, there's no mutuality here. There's no equality of power between the two sides, because the generation that's affected by our present actions have no means of negotiating with us about what we are doing. And so in both of these cases, there seems to be a need, at least it seems to me, there seems to be a need for both altruism and honesty. There's got to be some definite inclination on our part to act altruistically towards those who are poorer than us and those who are not yet born, who are going to be affected by what we do. And we've also got to be honest in assessing the effects of our policies and our behavior on these groups. And that actually adds to the moral complexity of trying to talk about this issue in the first place.
Thanks. Picking up on that and trying to give a real life example. Andrew mentioned e-waste. Ruben, I know that the Commission has been very active in trying to discourage irresponsible and harmful waste policies, you know, exporting waste around the world to poor countries from the affluent West, from Europe. Would you be able to talk a little bit about how the EU is trying to tackle this?
Well, yeah, so we have policies in place specifically focused on waste from electronics, the waste from electrical and electronic equipment, we call it WEE, with three E's, which sets targets for recycling, which sets collection requirements, which also includes a so-called extended producer responsibility fee, which imposes on the producers of that they participate or that they can contribute to the costs of handling of the waste that their products eventually produce. So that is in place. Is it enough? Is it working well enough? That's a different question. We do get indications that there are still big differences in what we what's brought onto the market and what is eventually handled in accordance with our policies. So in other words, there is stuff disappearing into more illegal circuits where it's maybe indeed a lot of it ends up outside of the EU and is in the end recycled there under conditions much less protected than we have here, which is of course not what we want, but it's hard for us to follow up on. So together with the member states, we do try to improve enforcement and compliance with our policies. And that's more or less where we stand.
And again, for any of you, what can be done to try to encourage design of technology mitigate harm and even start to reverse it. In our area, privacy and data protection, there is an obligation in the GDPR to develop products according to data protection by design and data protection by default. So, for example, there is an obligation to use the state of the art in order to minimize the amount of data which is used when you develop a product or code software, etc. Is there more that we can be doing now in order to steer technology into more sustainable directions?
Maybe this is a bit of a crude thought. I mean, I hadn't thought previously about your data point that you've just made, Christian, but the some people argue that nearly all the environmental impact of any product, especially electronic products and computers, are determined at the stage at which they're designed. And if they're not designed for dismantling and easy recycling of their components, then that's a design flaw. It's a really big issue to try and get reusable components out of a modern phone, for example, a portable phone. And so waste, if you think about it in this way, is a design flaw. And overcoming the waste challenge is actually itself a design challenge. And so I think if we're talking, as was mentioned earlier, about the circular economy, we should certainly be thinking about building in appropriate recycling and reuse of parts in at the design phase.
This is something we are addressing again, as I mentioned earlier, the Eco Design Directive. So far, I would say, has focused on energy efficiency. It's made our devices, but mostly sort of the more old-fashioned devices, if you like washing machines and refrigerators and dishwashers, made them much more energy efficient. And what we're looking at the moment is how we can expand that and adapt that better to the fast moving new devices like smartphones. So we are doing all sorts of studies how we can address that. And the focus is exactly on this, on more circular design, on perhaps more modular design, on already in the design phase thinking about how products are going to be recycled and to make sure that at least the design does not hamper recycling. And preferably actually even supports through modularity upgrading of phones so that just by replacing a few parts, the phone can continue its life rather than being discarded altogether. So these are elements that we are looking at. It's complicated, but we're trying.
I think from my side, what's interesting, and I kind of echo everything that's been said, that it starts from the beginning, but it also continues through to the end life of that design and that product, you know. And some of it is about accountability. You know, we would really like to see a future global standard for corporate accountability when it comes to sort of the risks that you're looking at in your supply chain around environmentalism, around human rights. We need companies to look holistically at how supply chains enable and exacerbate corruption and how they finance environmental destruction. So the design itself needs to consider that supply chain and consider what the risks are in a real sense, because as Ruben sort of outlined, there are a number of extremely exciting and well thought out approaches to developing sort of individual approaches on a huge number of things. But if there's not a kind of collective pressure around that accountability and across the whole life journey of an individual product that fuels our new sort of digital landscape, then there's a lot of places where that could fall down. So we need to look at it holistically from design and from the start of design through to the end of the design, and then from the whole use of the product, to ensure that we are performing adequate due diligence and bearing all of those different sort of pitfalls in mind.
Thank you. I'd like us to talk about artificial intelligence. I realized that none of us could claim to be great experts in artificial intelligence, but it's basically an idea that you can train machines to be almost as intelligent as us if you give them enough data. And there's a global, you could almost say there's a global arms race around this, particularly between China and the US and Europe trying to get in as well. But the one thing that they all I mean, the people get excited about robots and Terminators and people losing their jobs to machines, but the reality is that they are relying on enormous quantities of data in order to generate models, to try to quantify people and how they behave and how they're likely to behave given different stimuli. Would any of you like to reflect on an ethical response to this general direction of travel? This idea that connectedness, collecting data, is in and of itself a good thing, and what the implications are and will be for the environment and nature more generally?
I mean, yeah, it's a huge issue and a huge, I'm sure we could talk about this for days. I guess what Global Witness is about is, transparency and making sure that when it comes to data, that we are making that data accessible, and we like to open up data to people. And I won't pretend to be an expert on our sort of on our open data side. We have some amazing, I have some amazing colleagues who work on that. But I think in terms of how we move this forward, I think that sort of transparency and accountability is what can make data a positive and empowering force and can help people make useful changes. So I think for me, it's that kind of transparency around how it's being used and who has access to it, and a kind of democracy of data and a democracy of innovation around technology.
Andrew, what are your thoughts on the drive to quantify and measure everything in order to better control it and harness it?
Yes, the drive to quantify is interesting. I mean, your question about collecting data in and of itself, I don't think there is a straightforward answer to that question, because I don't think that it's a good thing in itself or a bad thing in itself. It very much depends on the context of use. And we've got to realize that digital technologies are like all other technologies. They bring with them possibilities of benevolent and good use, and they also bring with them possibilities of malevolent and bad use. And so in and of themselves, they need to be studied, they need to be understood, and they probably need to be controlled. But going back to your question about quantification, I think one of the things that worries me about the current state of our environmental debate is that we live in a big technological come economic system, and big data is just one manifestation of its tendency to quantify everything. If you think about quantification elsewhere, I mean, even in schools and universities nowadays, numbers are put on people's research capacity and their teaching ability, and it's all quantified as if that captures everything that's important in the situation. Now, when you apply that general quantification and giving a number to everything to nature, you start to get absurd results, because it doesn't matter if you value the Great Barrier Reef at so many billions of dollars. If the reef dies, putting the billions of dollars in the form of gold in the water is not a replacement for it. And so we've got this tendency to put a dollar value on things, or put a numerical value of another kind on things, when that value is actually meaningless when it starts to apply to things on which our life depends and from which we derive enormous value. So I think we've got to be very careful about this tendency to quantify everything.
One final question, a very general one. The climate movement, even degrowth movement, are among those who are questioning the assumption that the primary objective, public policy objective for states and I suppose also for businesses is growth. And there is a theory that the growth that has accrued as a result of since the Industrial Revolution 200-250 years ago coincides almost exactly with the intensive use of fossil fuels. Do you think that it's time to reconsider this basic tenet of public policy, that we need to grow the economy? Or is it a question of how we measure it? In New Zealand, I think they've swapped GDP for a happiness index or something like that. Is it a question of how we approach these things generally, or should we simply need a revolution in the in what our priorities should be for human behavior and interaction?
Well, I think in essence, it's in environment policies, we usually talk about decoupling. So the decoupling of our economic growth from the resources that are needed for that and from the CO2 emissions that are caused by economic growth. And if we can achieve that, then that will solve a lot of problems. It's very detailed, but in short, we say we're in a transition to a carbon neutral circular economy, where indeed the economic growth is generated through reuse and recycling of materials rather than virgin materials, and where CO2 emissions are avoided as much as possible. And of course, we are dependent on renewable energy rather than on fossil fuels. So I think this is the long-term perspective that perhaps more than ever today is seen as something that we all need to work toward. I guess there's a lot of discussion on whether it's going fast enough and if it's going fair enough and if it's going well enough. But I think a positive is that we have that long-term vision to work towards.
Yeah, I agree. The long-term vision is the key thing behind that, because I think, like you say, there are all kinds of different ways of reconfiguring that sort of global model, and you know, different ways of approaching growth and consumption. And I think one thing is around, you know, what's the kind of the assumption that we must continue to consume the same materials which we are now, like fossil fuels, and the fact, actually, quite concerningly, that it feels a need to kind of completely halt and restructure, rather than thinking about how we can, you know, make changes to our current methods of energy extraction, for example, to be able to move forward and manage the planet responsibly. So I think, I agree with what Ruben just said, and it's kind of this long-term approach to not only rethinking what growth means and what drives that growth, but also from my side, in terms of this kind of economic growth which you talked about, it's an accountability in terms of what we're pumping money into, or what we're allowing to be pumped, that money to be pumped into, and knowing that there's, you know, good due diligence, a form of mandatory due diligence that has been set out within more of a regulatory rather than a voluntary framework to ensure that economic growth is bearing in mind those sort of central principles around preserving people, around preserving the environment, and tackling climate breakdown.
Yes, we've got to be careful about how we talk about these things, though, because there's a kind of mantra that you get in various countries and various governments these days, where they say we must have economic growth in order to even develop the resources necessary for protecting the environment. And sometimes that takes a very strange form of argument that says we need to go on using fossil fuels in order to get to a state where we no longer need to depend on them. And that kind of caters to tendencies towards self-deception, which I think are terribly important in discussing what's happening in environmental matters. I mean, philosophers in the 20th century, as different as Hannah Arendt and Jean-Paul Sartre, talked about the difficulty of getting free from self-deception in our thinking and in the structures of thoughts we have. And Arendt made, I think, a really insightful comment that politicians who tell us lies are not distorting what they think is the truth. Rather, they already believe their own lies to some extent, so they're self-deceived even in the way that they tell their lies to us. And I think human beings are always struggling against this, and it's a real struggle that we need to take seriously. We've got to, as I said earlier, we've got to be altruistic and honest in our approach to matters of climate justice and relationships between countries. And I think in order to do that, we've got to be aware of our own weaknesses, our tendency to tell ourselves comforting lies, our tendency to be weak-willed, which is another thing philosophers have written about at great length. These are all things that are there in the background, and they're there when people speak on behalf of governments and corporations, and we've really got to just unmask them and get rid of them to have an honest discussion.
Well, thank you very much. Are there any points that you wanted to make that you haven't been able to in the last 50 minutes?
Sorry, I don't want to be too depressing about this. I thought it might be better to end on a cheerful note. Arne Næss, whom I mentioned before as the Norwegian deep ecologist, used to say back in the 80s and 90s that he thought the 21st century would be a challenging one for human society and human beings. He thought we wouldn't learn our lesson, our ecological lesson, until there had been several catastrophes. And he thought the 22nd century might see an improvement in things. That was his modified optimism. My version of optimism is actually slightly more truncated than his. I mean, it seems to me that the world is beginning to wake up to what's going on, and that by the middle of this century, if not sooner, we will actually have a change in public view and attitude that actually puts the environment in pride of place where it belongs, which is the very essential thing for supporting our lives and our existence on Earth.
I think that's a wonderful way to end the conversation. But I think also, I totally agree. And I think, I hope that happens. And I think for us, it's kind of about making sure that we also put pressure on those businesses, on those, you know, regulators, on those policymakers, on governments, to make sure that we have a responsible approach around how we extract natural resources, and also how we see the interlinkedness between people and planet, and how those two things can be completely harmonious and supportive, and how we should kind of drive towards that vision and make sure that, you know, the actions that could stop that are by companies or otherwise accountable and transparent, and that we can build a more sustainable economy that way.
Yeah, well, I can only agree with all that, of course. From an environmental perspective, this is what we're working for, to get both the sense of urgency across and to work on solutions. So yeah, I agree. I think there is also reason for optimism, given the spike we've seen in the sense of urgency and in the political profile that climate and environment discussions are getting now. And the challenge, I think, will be for all of us, and it's a big challenge, to keep explaining that well, and to making sure that we show that it does not have to go at the expense of prosperity. It does not have to go coupled with inequality or a rise in inequality. On the contrary, in fact, if we do it right through circular economy, it offers both opportunities for both economic growth and fair economic growth and environment. And this is what we're really working on. It's there's no easy answers, but I think the long-term agenda is good, and we need to make sure we bring that across well.
Okay, well, thank you all very much indeed. You've done an excellent job in covering very, very broad issues, and you even managed to finish on an optimistic note. The next podcast is going to be on digital ethics and children, so following on from the focus on the future, and I expect that we'll touch on some of these themes when we have that discussion too. But I'd just like to thank, on behalf of EDPS, Heather Iqbal, Professor Andrew Brennan, and Ruben Decker for your time and for your expertise, and for sharing your thoughts with us.